From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Zelda Gilroy, she was brainy and assertive, but all she wanted to do was marry Dobie Gillis. Sheila James Kuehl is the actress who played Zelda on The Dobie Gillis Show. Her acting career ended because of rumors she was a lesbian. She was. The end of her acting career led to another she liked even better. She's a feminist lawyer who runs the California Women's Law Center. Coming up, we meet actress turned feminist activist Sheila James Kuehl. Also, Grace Paley joins us to read some new poems, talk about the old neighborhood, and reflect on her years as a peace activist. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers an alternative to the question, can computers think? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council has resumed talks on proposed economic sanctions against Libya, NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Council members met briefly this afternoon to discuss the sanctions resolution. The talks will continue tomorrow, and diplomats say the measure should come up for a vote either tomorrow or early next week. The resolution would ban arms sales and air traffic to Libya in an effort to force Tripoli to surrender two men wanted in connection with the downing of Pan Am Flight 103. China and India are seeking minor changes in the text, but the resolution is expected to pass. Meanwhile, Arab group officials continued to try to negotiate a compromise. But Libya's flip-flop earlier this week over whether it would release the suspects has left a residue of bad feelings, and most non-aligned countries on the council are now expected to support the resolution. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Iowa Senator Tom Harkin threw his support to Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton today. Harkin dismissed his own campaign criticism of the Arkansas governor as water under the bridge and promised to lobby aggressively to get labor support for Clinton. Harkin won strong backing from organized labor before he gave up his own bid for the nomination. His lobbying apparently paid off in the form of an endorsement for Clinton from the Communications Workers of America. The support of the Communications Union president, Morton Barr, is regarded as particularly significant. Barr's been a critic of Clinton in the past, and he's an influential member of the AFL-CIO Executive Council. The Defense Department today released a list of 830 National Guard and Reserve units it wants to reduce or eliminate over the next 2 years. The proposed reductions would end military service for nearly 150,000 people in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. We have details from NPR's Neil Conan.
The Army National Guard and Reserves stand to lose the most, 125,000 in all. There are relatively small cuts in the Navy and Marine Corps, and plans call for the Air Force Reserves to actually go up a bit. 80% of the units identified today were assigned to support active duty forces based in Europe that are being decommissioned with the end of the Cold War. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney said if there's no reason to keep the active duty units, there's no need for the reserves either. The cuts would maintain the current proportion of active duty to reserve forces of about 2-to-1. The cuts would save an estimated $20 billion over the next 6 years, but many in Congress would prefer to find cuts elsewhere in the Pentagon budget, since local armories are an important source of income for many communities. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Blue chip stocks scored a slight gain today after a session of mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at 3,267.67. Declines edged advances in active trading of about 177 million shares. This is NPR News. The Irish government has proposed a change in its abortion laws that would allow women to obtain information about the option of having abortions in other countries. Ireland's restrictive abortion laws came to international attention last month when a 14-year-old girl won a court battle to be allowed to travel to Britain for an abortion. The girl said her pregnancy was the result of a rape. Abortion is illegal in Ireland, except in cases where the mother's life is in danger. Student organizations have also been prohibited from providing information that would allow Irish women to seek abortions in other countries. Doctors say President Bush's health is perfect following a routine 5-hour checkup today at Bethesda Naval Hospital. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Everything was judged normal after Mr. Bush went through a range of tests on his heart and eyes, as well as x-rays of the chest, neck, and hips. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said there is no evidence of skin cancer, but doctors did use liquid nitrogen to freeze four very minute blemishes known as keratosis. But even after giving the president a clean bill of health, his personal physician, Dr. Burton Lee, wishes Mr. Bush would take some time off.
I strongly urge him. I would love him to go away for 3 weeks, and obviously he's not going to do that.
Well, why?
Why not? I don't care how much activity you thrive on. This is the most demanding job in the world.
But Dr. Lee acknowledges his patient probably won't follow his advice. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The number of people filing new claims for unemployment benefits went up in mid-March. The Labor Department said that 447,000 people applied for unemployment in the week that ended on March 14th, 15,000 more than the week before. Weekly unemployment claims are subject to a lot of fluctuation, but they're considered a good early indicator of improvements in the job market. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Dobie, wants a gal that's dreamy. Dobie, wants a gal that's dreamy. Dobie, wants a gal to call his own. Is she blonde? Is she tall? Is she dark? Is she small? Is she any kind of dreamboat at all?
Of the many loves of Dobie Gillis, the girl who loved him the most and the longest was Zelda Gilroy. She was brainy and aggressive, but she wasn't quite the dreamboat Dobie was looking for. The actress who played Zelda doesn't watch the Dobie reruns on Nick at Night. She's too busy with her work as a woman's rights lawyer. My guest is actress-turned-activist Sheila James Kuhl. Her acting career ended shortly after the Dobie Gillis show. Now she believes no one wanted to hire her because of rumors she was a lesbian. The rumors were true. When the work stopped, she went back to school, became a feminist, studied law, and put the two together. Her 8-page resume is very impressive. She now directs the California Women's Law Center. She's taught classes on gender and the law at several universities. She was president of the Women Lawyers Association of Los Angeles and was the second woman in the history of Harvard Law School to win the moot court competition. On page 3 of her resume, under the heading Other Employment, she lists actress, Dobie Gillis series, 1959 to 1963.
Every decade, I sort of look back on my life, and I had my 50th birthday last year, and I see things much more contextually. It seems like a continuum to me, and the acting, I did it for 15 years. You don't want to lose 15 years of your life, even if it was from the age of 9 to 24, which people don't normally put on their resume. But it's all part of, I think, my ability to talk and to feel comfortable in a huge variety of places. I mean, I grew up working class, but as soon as I started acting as a kid, I did a TV series called Trouble with Father, which was the first film television series. And all of a sudden, you know, they were taking me to lunch at the Brown Derby, and I'd never eaten anywhere but the counter at Thrifty's drugstore. So it lent a great deal to my life, and I like to see it on the resume. It's sort of fun.
So how old were you when you got the part?
18.
And how did you like the character?
I loved her. I still think of her as sort of my little sister. It's interesting because once the women's movements sort of came to blossom in the 70s, I started getting a lot of letters from women who were coming to consciousness as feminists telling me that they now remembered Zelda very fondly because she was the only girl on television in all those times in the early 60s who had a brain. I mean, she not only had a brain, but she was smarter than everyone in the world, who was aggressive, who knew what she wanted, went and got it. She was going to go to medical school. She, of course, on the other hand, she really thought it was Dobie who ought to be president of the United States. And her main, aspiration was to marry him. And interestingly enough, in the reunion movies, in the first reunion movie, Zelda was in law school. In the second reunion movie, she was working in the grocery store married to Dobie. So it's just a difference, I think, between the late 70s and late 80s, just in terms of how the movie was written. And it's sort of relationship history that kind of reflects culture, I think.
Do you have a favorite Dobie episode?
I do. It was called Dobie, Dobie, Who's Got the Dobie? And it was really about Zelda being totally heartsick because Dobie won't have anything to do with her, which, of course, was the theme of their entire relationship. And he was chasing another woman. And at some point, Zelda places herself in the soda shop within full view of Dobie and this new woman. And she's wearing widow's attire, you know, black from head to foot with a veil over her face. And she's sobbing uncontrollably at this table. And Dobie comes over and he says, Zelda, you know, you're breaking my heart. You're ruining my romance. I need you to do something for me. And if you really, really love me, you will. And Zelda says, anything, Poopsie, I'll do anything for you. And he says, smile. And she says, smile? He says, smile. So I started smiling, and he keeps saying, wider, wider, wider. And finally, she's got this huge grin that goes from ear to ear, which is not in her eyes. You know what I mean? This hideous grin. And she says, I'm cracking my face. And he says, now laugh. And so she starts laughing, and I built up this maniacal laugh that went for almost a minute and a half, that just built up to, you know, this peak. And then she pulls out a bottle of poison and drinks it. And the show itself is, it has wonderful feeling to it. And I don't know, it's my favorite. I think it was the best work I ever did.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sheila James Kuehl. You probably know her as the actress who played Zelda Gilroy on the Dobie Gillis series. She has since become a feminist activist, a lawyer. She now heads the Southern California Women's Law Center. It's very difficult for young people to grow up on camera, which you did. But it might have been especially difficult to grow up on camera and start realizing, maybe I'm a lesbian. Because this was at a period when it was pretty socially unacceptable. There wasn't much of a gay rights movement, not much in terms of support. So did you start going through this kind of inner questioning in front of in the period when you were in front of the camera?
Terry, you're the mistress of understatement. You say there wasn't much of a movement, and it was sort of like not too cool to be queer. Yes, it was very, like, if you count losing your career, losing your family, losing the people in your religion, being fired from whatever you're doing, yeah, it was totally uncool.
Did you lose all that?
Yeah, I don't miss any of that, actually. It's the closet was just awful. I'll tell you, it was totally frightening. It was terrifying. First of all, I had no context in which to put the fact that I was falling in love with a woman. I thought it was so bizarre and so strange and so unnatural, and yet it felt so right, that I simply kept the relationship, of course, extremely, extremely, extremely secret from my parents, from everybody, never told a friend, I mean, for years. And in the third year that we were doing Dobie, Zelda was getting a lot of fan mail, and Max Schulman, and everyone loved her character. So Max wrote a pilot, a spin-off pilot, in which I would star, that featured Zelda as the lead character. And we made the pilot for the series, and CBS was extremely high on the series. And all of a sudden, the pilot just dropped like a stone, and nobody talked about it anymore. And finally, the director had the courage and compassion, I think, to take me aside and ask if we could go for a walk, and told me that there was this rumor that, that I was, not straight, essentially. And it was just a rumor, and no one knew where it came from, but it was enough to get CBS to completely scotch the pilot. And I only did 4 shows the next year in Dobie, and that was it. So the homophobia in the industry, which of course only reflects how strong it is outside the industry, has devastated, I think, some careers. And to tell you the truth, I never even thought about it that much myself. I mean, people would say, why did you leave show business? And I would make some, weak joke about how, you don't leave show business. The phone just stops ringing. And that's what happened to me. And but it was homophobia.
What word did the, who did you say it was, the director who took you aside?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What word did he use for lesbian when he was talking with you? Do you remember?
Well, I think that he said, they think you're just too butch. Which, of course, is a great joke now, I think.
Well, I'm sure the irony wasn't lost on you that, here you were in love with a woman and playing on TV this woman who is just addicted to Dobie Gillis.
Well, it may seem funny now, but I don't see it really. The more important, interesting thing to me, I think, was the fact that she was the strongest female character on television.
Mm-hmm.
She was capable and competent and smart, but her whole idea was she wanted to marry him and have him be successful. And what Max, I think, realized was this is not what Dobie wanted either. He wanted to be a poet. He didn't care about money. He didn't care about success. And so everybody was after something that was totally wrong for their lives in a way, which made them all losers.
When the director took you aside and told you that there was a rumor that you were a lesbian and you figured out this was really going to hurt your career, was anyone explicit with you about what the studio's fears were?
No. Oh, no. Everyone was very embarrassed. It's like people talking to their kids about sex. I mean, you just don't talk about it. That was it. What I told you is what he told me. And there was like this piece of ice that came into my heart. I didn't know what it would mean. I was simply afraid that I would be found out. I couldn't even imagine it would affect my career. You don't think about it. I mean, I was 20 years old, okay? I didn't think, oh, how awful, I won't work again.
Was, do you know if anybody, like, gossiped about you on the set or was overtly malicious? And of course, it was malicious to kind of basically throw you out of the industry, but I mean just
No, I know that no one did.
Uh-huh.
Dwayne didn't know. Bob Denver didn't know. It was a total secret. I mean, no one even thought about it very much in those days.
Did you have anyone you could talk to about this?
No one. Not one person.
Not even your lover?
Well, I mean, it was not clear to me what effect it was going to have. I knew that the pilot didn't sell, but I'm telling you, it's now so many years later, and it's the first time I've ever started even to come to grips with the fact that my acting career probably stopped in great part because of this rumor. But I never thought about it then. We didn't have the word homophobia. I didn't know there was a gay or lesbian community. I didn't know there was anybody like me. And I simply put it out of my consciousness. And I really believed, I think, for a long time. Because there were other actors who, you know, the series stops and they didn't work. I think I believed that it was simply sort of luck of the draw, and sometimes you work and sometimes you don't, and now it was over. And, of course, as it turns out, it was an enormously good thing for my life that I stopped acting, because over the course of the 70s, the women's movement reached out and grabbed me. I went to law school, and now I love what I do. Much more than I ever loved acting, which was a lot.
After the Dobie Gillis series, you were in another series called Broadside that was like a female version of McHale's Navy.
Right.
Was being a lesbian an issue in getting that series? I mean, they didn't know about the rumor.
I don't think so.
Yeah. No. Dick Sargent was in that series, too. And
yes, he was.
And he has since come out. As a matter of fact, you came out on TV together. So did you know that he was gay, and did he know that you were a lesbian when you were working together?
After the show, we came over the course of the year that we did Broadside. We met each other's lovers, and over time afterward would have dinner together. I knew his lover Frank just about up until the time Frank died, I think. And, you know, these were both very long-term relationships. My generation got married and was essentially monogamous, in the women's community, at least. And they, you know, we would have dinner and we knew about it.
You said before that, you know, through coming out, you lost your family and your religion.
No. I said that you could. You personally didn't. No. No, actually, but I didn't come out to my parents for 20 years after that.
It's a long time.
A long time. And, of course, my mother, bless her heart, looked at me with this sort of sad, understanding, wise look and said, "Oh, honey, we always knew you liked girls better."
Really?
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sheila James Kuehl, who starred as Zelda Gilroy in Dobie Gillis and for years has been an activist feminist lawyer and now heads a women's law center in Southern California. And we're talking about her life. So we'll be back after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Sheila James Kuehl is my guest. When your acting career was ended, were you angry or disappointed? What did you feel at the time?
I think I was just mostly really sad and really scared about how I was going to earn my living. I didn't feel I had any skills that would help me earn a living. I didn't even know how smart I was. And I went back to UCLA, which is where I had graduated while I was working on Dobie in the year after, and just begged them basically for a job. I had been in the student government and loved, we weren't activists yet in that generation, but I loved that stuff, and was fortunate enough to be hired working with students at UCLA, which is what eventually led to my going to law school.
How do you think you ended up becoming an activist as opposed to being a kind of bitter, injured person? You know what I mean? A lot of people who have the kind of experience...
You don't think I'm a bitter, injured person, huh?
No, a lot of people who have the kind of experience you had would perhaps never recover from it.
I don't know. I think some kind of genetic makeup that goes to humor. I'm not really sure. Every time something happens, it's devastating. I feel absolutely devastated, but it also sort of strikes me funny in a way. The sort of cosmic joke. I don't know whether I'm so evolved or what. But I guess the probably the best answer to your question is that my parents made me feel very secure, and a lot of people's parents don't. They just loved the hell out of me. And they never actually made me feel insecure by... you know, that they were critical or they thought I was going to get a swelled head. It was just fine with them if I got a swelled head when I was a kid. They thought I was terrific. And it made me feel growing up as though the most important place in my universe for confidence was really inside myself. And it really helps you bounce back from a lot of stuff.
Tell me how you started becoming involved with feminist issues and started to see yourself as a feminist.
Well, in the 70s, I was working, in the early 70s, when I went to work at UCLA, I was working in an office that advises student organizations, and I was given to advise the SDS, the Progressive Labor Party, the Women's Liberation Front, the Black Student Union, and the fledgling Chicano students, because there were no people of color in my office, of course, and they didn't want very much advice, but they started sort of rolling around to my apartment late at night just to talk strategy. You know, what can I do and not get arrested? And then I would say half the point is to get arrested. And we started getting in touch in the office and in other student services offices with the fact that women students were not really getting all the services they need. Housing, psychological, medical, whatever the non-academic services were. So we called a meeting, those of us who were sort of in middle management in these student services, to talk about what women might need in these services. And it was exactly the same day as the day that I found out that I had not gotten a promotion in my office, and that a man who was hired later than I was promoted instead. And I basically got in touch with the fact that I really felt screwed over by not getting this promotion, and that I was starting to see in this, what Ms. used to call a click, I had a click. And the click was, I didn't get this promotion because I'm a woman. And I found out later that the man who denied my promotion had said, she's just too aggressive, which, of course, he did not say about the man that got the promotion. And at that point, I got really mad. And when I get mad, I get going. I have a lot of energy. So I organized a group of women to open a women's resource center at UCLA, and I'm proud to say I am the mother of the women's resource center there. And we opened it against the chancellor's orders. I almost got fired, but we did it. And we had the first Women's Week, I think it was 20 years ago now. It was a very exciting time, and before I knew it, I was a feminist.
Were you out then?
No, I was not out. As a matter of fact, I was going through a straight phase at that time.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean this in any funny way, but since my first lover of my whole life was a woman and it was a long-term relationship, I was curious. And I didn't sleep with any men until I was, 29 or 30. And then I decided, well, maybe I have to see what this is all about. And so I slept with a whole bunch of them. All my friends, though, no strangers, okay? And it was a wonderful time in my life.
Now, in your legal work, you've worked a lot with issues of domestic abuse, sex discrimination, reproductive rights. Can you tell us about an action or legal decision that you were involved with that you feel had the most impact on women or that you feel most proud of?
Well, it depends on what you mean by involved with, because so much of the work that women do in the law is really collaborative and coalition work, especially at the policy level. 2 years ago in California, after 7 years of work, a bill that I had worked personally on for 7 years, simply to require judges to take domestic violence into account in custody decisions, was finally passed. It had enormous opposition, which, of course, should make us understand how important it is for men to get away with violence in their relationship and still to be considered good fathers. But we overcame the opposition, and I'm very proud of that because I think that was good law center and good personal work.
Do you ever have the urge to act anymore?
Well, sometimes I do, mostly when I wonder how I'm going to pay the house insurance, you know, things like that. But then every 10 years we've done a reunion movie, and both times we've done them, it has come back to me very strongly that I'm really, really, really glad that I'm doing what I'm doing now and not that.
Why?
Well, you get up at 5:30 in the morning, you go into makeup at 6 o'clock in a place with no windows, put on the makeup, go to the set, work in a place with no windows and no phone that, you know, I mean, there's a phone, but you can't spend all day on the phone like I do, talking to people who are doing incredibly interesting and important work. You do some scenes with the effect that you're probably going to make some people laugh down the line. You don't choose the people that you're with. They're people who were cast, and they're nice enough, but, you know, they're not necessarily political or anything. You're exhausted. You go home. You sleep. You get up, and you start over. It's essentially meaningless. From the activist point of view. You know, I mean, I think Candace Bergen is doing a great job of bringing a feminist character to the, you know, to America. Designing Women does a great job in bringing up the issues and the shows they do. I think it's real important work. But I think the most that activist actresses and actors do, really, is to recognize that it's their responsibility to use their celebrity in order to anoint a cause and just show up. But you don't find any of them being the theorists or strategists for the movement, etc. They're essentially their celebrity. They show up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's not enough for me anymore.
Do you think there's going to ever be a made-for-TV movie about your life?
Sure. But not until after I am elected to the state assembly and maybe the state senate and maybe the Congress.
Are you going to try to run?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to run for the state assembly as soon as the seat. I filed to run this year, but a good friend of women and gays and lesbians who was already in the assembly didn't have a district anymore because, you know, our state's been totally redistricted like so many have. And he moved into my district, and I didn't want to run against him. So I essentially said, okay, I'll wait. We have, as the rest of the world probably knows, term limits here in California. So I said, I'll wait, and I'm running as soon as you're not. So I will. And then maybe they'll make a movie about me. But only if I win, I'm sure.
Right, right, right. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
Sheila James Kuehl directs the California Women's Law Center. And you can see her as Zelda Gilroy on the Dobie Gillis reruns on Nick at Night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Grace Paley has said, art is too long and life is too short, to explain why her body of work isn't larger. For years, she's been a peace and women's rights activist, as well as a writer and teacher. Coming up, Grace Paley reads from her new collection of poems and reflects on her life. And linguist Jeff Nunberg wonders if we could ask more of computers than just intelligence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Health and Human Services Department has unveiled its new AIDS advertising campaign. These ads are aimed at heterosexuals, women, and teenagers, groups where the Centers for Disease Control has found AIDS increasing most rapidly. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
Every 13 minutes, another American becomes infected with the AIDS virus, according to the CDC. In some cities, the rate of new infections among heterosexuals has surpassed infection rates among gay and bisexual men. The new ads are directed at a wider range of groups. They feature young people who have become infected with the virus but do not show their faces in order to be more inclusive.
My name is Frankie Austin. I always thought that having a man who loved me would keep me safe. Until I got HIV. What's bad is that most women still don't protect themselves. And I don't want anyone else getting AIDS. Now I do everything I can to teach women that love alone just won't protect them. Sometimes I think I'll die trying.
AIDS activists and educators criticized the campaign today, saying that in order to be effective, people need to be told repeatedly how you get the virus and to use a condom. I'm Brenda Wilson.
Democratic presidential candidate Jerry Brown began several days of campaigning in Wisconsin today. At a news conference in Milwaukee, Brown tried to shrug off Tom Harkin's endorsement of Bill Clinton. Chuck Quarmbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Brown was reported tired and in need of rest earlier in the day, but when he arrived in Milwaukee, Brown was feisty about Senator Harkin's support of Clinton.
When you run a frontal assault on what you call a decrepit and corrupt status quo that no longer serves the American people, you can't be surprised if people in that neighborhood band together in a mutual protection defense one more time.
Brown also fought back against New York Senator Daniel Moynihan's latest attack on Brown's flat tax program, with Brown saying the proposal would not destroy Social Security. Brown has various rallies scheduled at universities and labor halls in the next few days, in a push to capture Wisconsin's April 7 primary. For National Public Radio, this is Chuck Quarmbach in Milwaukee.
Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has named more than 800 National Guard and Reserve units to undergo cuts amounting to more than 140,000 jobs. Cheney estimates these cuts will save $20 billion over 5 years' time. Cheney said that 80% of these proposed cuts are units designed to support active-duty forces in the event of war against the former Warsaw Pact. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 8 points to close at 3,267.67 in active trading. This is NPR News. Former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has been sentenced to 6 years in prison on a rape conviction and sent directly to jail. Tyson was also fined $30,000. A prosecution requests that Tyson pay about $150,000 in trial expenses was denied, as he was ordered to pay a standard $113 in court cost. Tyson could be released after 3 years in prison, pending good behavior. Tyson was led from the courtroom today by 5 sheriff's deputies, and this afternoon he was taken in handcuffs to a prison reception center. Israel today established direct telephone links with 10 Arab countries. Several Arab states have sharply protested. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israelis can now reach out and touch someone in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, or even the PLO headquarters in Tunis. The Israeli telephone company Bezeq set up the direct lines, which are the first with any Arab countries except Egypt. Until now, Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank used a private Israeli company and had to book the calls in advance. But the new service isn't cheap. A call to Amman, Jordan, for example, costs $3 a minute, more than a call to Washington. And Amman is less than 50 miles away from Jerusalem. A spokesman for the communications ministry said the move is a goodwill gesture. But several Arab spokesmen disagreed because Israel did not ask Arab states' permission before setting up the lines. The Jordanian communications minister called it piracy and ordered operators to block the phone calls. But an Israeli telephone operator in Jerusalem said he had received more than 100 requests for information on how to dial directly. He said all the lines were jammed. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Labor Department says that new claims for state unemployment benefits rose in the latest reporting week. New claims were up by 15,000 for the week ending March 14th. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Grace Paley was named New York's first official state writer in 1986, she said the only thing nicer might be if she got an award from her block. Well, that'll give you a sense of what she writes about, the people from the neighborhood. Her neighborhoods have been the Bronx, where she grew up, Greenwich Village, where she raised her children, and Vermont, where she now lives. Vermont is a surprising place for the writer Anne Tyler once described as urban to an unusual degree. Paley is best known for her three collections of short stories and for her work as a peace and women's rights activist. She wrote poems even before she wrote stories, and she has a new book of new and collected poems. Here's one of them.
This poem called Housing is, it's really, I mean, I sort of wrote it as a kind of a joke, and some people are more serious about it, but I was just thinking of my own neighborhood that I lived in, which was the village that I had lived in, and how people think about it. And I'll just read it, I think. Walking along a street in a neighborhood where the black trash bags are stacked as neat as a wood pile in Vermont, my lover said to me, "Oh, will we ever live in a district like this where the artists are growing old in brownstones and their grandchildren visit them with watercolors and pastels? If we could only find a condominium or a co-op like the one on 9th Street, where the tenants themselves have lovingly laid a mulch of pine branches among the roses." Then I answered my lover, "It is probably too late for sentiment of that kind. We are fated to create our own community in the borough of Brooklyn or Staten Island, though there are many who are happy in the little cities across the river in another state, where we might well establish patterns of comfort and gently rising affluence, all of which requires, of course, that the earth be not blown up or irremediably poisoned, and that you and I remain, if not lovers, at least cordial creators of family and continuity."
So this is a conversation you imagine people having walking through your old neighborhood?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, they like, people walk down 11th Street and they look in the windows. And I remember 45 years ago, or maybe 50. No, yeah, maybe 50, doing the same thing.
Now, you have a home in Vermont now.
Yes.
Do you still have a place in New York?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So you're living in both worlds.
Well, I live basically now in Vermont. It's in my husband's hometown, and that's where I live. And I come to New York, and I miss it.
I remember you once telling me that your sense of kind of like folk stories or folk tales was gossip.
Yeah.
And that gossip was just a great source material for you, and you wanted the sound of it, the informality of it, the style of it in your writing.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if like the gossip is different in a town in Vermont than it is on the stoops of Manhattan apartments.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot more of it occurs on the telephone because the distances are very great. But I mean, I think of gossip as sort of just a normal oral histories that people tell each other all the time, and it happens there. But you know, it's the kind of thing actually that you do with very close friends over a long period of time. And basically, most of my friends are here, although I have very good friends in Vermont. But my gabbier ones are in New York.
Grace, there's a poem I'm going to ask you to read called Fear.
Right.
And this is a poem that you wrote in Vermont.
Yes, I did. This poem is called Fear. I am afraid of nature. Because of nature, I am mortal. My children and my grandchildren are also mortal. I lived in the city for 40 years, In this way, I escaped fear.
When did you write that? What were you thinking about?
I didn't write it too long ago. I was really, I really meant what I said. I was simply thinking of the movement of life and death in the fields and in the mountains and the animals around me, and which you're very close to. You're much more close to it. You know, we think about the cities as being so dangerous and full of guns and so forth, but in a very strange way, you really are closer to birth and life and death in the countryside.
Do you find living in the country brings out different anxieties in you than living in the city?
I'm not an anxious person.
Gosh, you're lucky. No, I envy you.
I mean, I worry, but I'm not anxious.
Writer Grace Paley is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Grace Paley, and she has a new book called New and Collected Poems. You've been an activist all of your adult life,
mm-hmm.
peace activist, anti-nuclear
mm-hmm.
activist.
Mm-hmm.
But as an adult, I think some of your activist work really started with the PTA, which would in some ways be a surprising place for peace activism to start.
Well, it's true, but I think I had very strong pacifist leanings before that, but having children made me feel more so, and I've always believed in working where I am, you know, and so my children went to school, so I just naturally began to work. In my community, which was the village, and I was in the PTA, and I really loved that period. I mean, I worked with parents, people like myself, who were in the same line of work, child rearing, and that was really really great. And then at around that time, the kids were being told that they had to hide under desks because they were about to be blown up or something like that. So I became very involved in that, and my own daughter, I remember as a very young child, refused to do that.
Oh, she refused to duck and cover?
Yeah, she did. And so I was very concerned already about all that. And then as time went on, I could see the war, the Vietnam War coming.
You've described yourself as a combative pacifist and a cooperative anarchist. Do you still think of yourself in that way?
Yeah, I seem to be living that way. I am, I'd say, more of a pacifist as time goes on, and I'd say that I try to be more cooperative as time goes on. But I think those are fair. I think they sort of omitted my very strong feelings about feminism, and I want to include that in as fast as I can.
You know, the kind of activism you were involved in was in some ways more typical of your children's generation than your own? Just in terms of the proportion of people who participated in those kinds of anti-war activities. I wonder if you ever felt separate from many people of your generation.
From my generation? No, we really had a lot of, in our peace center, there were people, most of the people were around our age. But it certainly is true that I remember going on one particular demonstration or action where everybody really treated me as a rather old person when I really must have been about 44 or something like that. So I always remember that, and I have young friends now who were friends of mine at that time, people in the resistance movement, which I regarded us, my age group's responsibility to support as much and as deeply as possible. I see these friends of mine now who are in their early 40s having to deal with people who are 20 who are as mean to them as they were to me. And I laugh.
How are they mean to you?
How were they?
Yeah.
Well, they really were. I mean, they treated us like older people, like old people. And as I said, we were about 43 or 4.
You were always, it seems to me, close in some ways to the generation older than you, your parents' generation. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the characters in your short stories are from your parents' generation, the first generation of Eastern European Jews to come to New York.
Yeah.
And you capture their language and their spirit. And there's a poem I want you to read about giving political leaflets to people of that generation in your neighborhood.
Yeah. I wrote this poem. Again, it's something I wrote. I tend to write poems not only out of grief and anxiety, but also for fun too. So this one is called Street Corner Dialogue, and it's true. Thank God for the old Jewish ladies. Though their sons are splendid with houses and brilliant from college, they take our leaflets. Sometimes they say, Pishers, what's on your mind? Don't get excited. Hitler is dead. Where are the sweatshops? Then we say, Mrs., did you forget Vietnam? I won't speak about Israel. Turn around maybe 80 degrees. You'll see a few sweatshops. Not to mention imperialism's furnace, the nation of Africa. They answer, of course. Oh, yes, as usual, we heard it before. Naturally, the poor people are dying, dying, dying. Foolish girl, listen, you'll never stop at the dying from killing. Then we tell them, only five words. So, why did you live? Uh-oh, a fresh mouth. But, darling, you're right. In your life, you shouldn't give up the ship. So long you got strength. Maybe this world wouldn't turn out a total disaster.
I like that poem a lot. Did you feel that in their own way, the older people in the neighborhood were encouraging to you?
They were. And it's true. I mean, I actually wrote this fairly recently, so I'm just about as old as they are. But what I was feeling very much was, that they... You, when you stand on a street corner and give out leaflets, a lot of people don't take them, and you begin to see who's taking them, who's not taking them, and you begin to develop theories and ideas, most of which are false. But in this case, I noticed that these old ladies, old Jewish ladies like me, were taking the leaflets.
Tell me why you've always had an affinity as a writer for describing people like that.
Well, I really do describe... really lots of other kinds of people, but I think mostly in my first book, I think I had to go and deal with with my own family and think about how they had come and lived on this American earth, and I'm actually not through with it. I think I seemed more in the middle of my writing life to have gone away from that to a very present tense. I in my own mind now, I'm going back to some of the other stuff, to certain mysteries about that period. And an example would be that I'm very interested in, and have written a poem and some stories even about an uncle of mine who was deported during the Palmer raids in the 1920s and early 1920s or late 19s. And my family never talked about him. And it's something that has perplexed me, and I don't understand it. So you really write about what you don't understand, So I'm up to not understanding that right now.
You said you were curious. You wanted to kind of find out more about the mysteries of how your parents came here. There's actually a really interesting story behind some of that I'd like for you to tell, about how the Tsar let political prisoners
off. Oh, yeah, right. You know that story, right. what happened was that my parents in Russia were political people, were socialists, and very active and very young also. They must have been 19, 20 years old. And my father was imprisoned and sent to Arkhangelsk, really, and my mother was sent into exile. And then the Tsar Nicholas, had a son, and when he had a son, he pardoned everybody under 21, And in this way, my parents were pardoned. My father was pardoned. My mother came back from Germany. And they got on a boat pretty fast and came to the United States.
Did they understand your activism?
They did. I mean, they understood it, but they really were they were bothered by it because, like a lot of immigrants who come here, they became extremely patriotic. And although they didn't give up lots of their politics, they would be very disturbed, say, in those early years, you know, in the 1930s and 20s and so forth. About treatments of blacks and things. I mean, their basic politics were really they're very deep and humane, in every way. But in the beginning of my being against, especially the Vietnam War or anti-nuclear work or anything like that, they were really troubled in a way and felt that I was, you know, spending too much time doing all of that. And on the other hand, my mother died when I was in my 20s, but my father came around to a lot of stuff, and I have a couple of poems even on his worries about the fact that he was going to die before Nixon or Johnson figured how to get out of the war.
I'm wondering if he was protective of you since he was exiled because of his political beliefs under the Tsar in Russia. He might have felt that you were going to be punished for your political beliefs in the United States.
Oh, yes. No, they felt like that. I think they also my father, because my mother was dead, I think he also felt a little pleased at the same time that he worried. He was pleased.
That you were carrying on his legacy in some way.
Yeah.
Well, Grace Paley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Grace Paley's new book, New and Collected Poems, is published by Tilbury House. Paley is one of many writers who the FBI once kept a file on. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from the author of a new book about the FBI's surveillance of American writers. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We have some health stories today, Terry. The federal government has unveiled its new campaign to curtail the spread of AIDS. Critics say it is not likely to be very effective, that AIDS is spreading to new groups of people. We're also going to take another look at the American Cancer Society's statistic on breast cancer, that 1 in 9 American women are likely to get the disease. Also, Mike Tyson was sentenced today. Tom Harkin endorsed Bill Clinton today. The Pentagon announced that a number of reserve units will be cut from the defense budget, and we have your letters on the show today.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We've come to think of computers as smart and responsive, but as intellectually stimulating as our relationships with computers may be, linguist Jeff Nunberg wonders how far these relationships can go.
Can machines think? That's how the remarkable English mathematician Alan Turing began a famous article in the British philosophical journal Mind back in 1950. It was an audacious question to pose at a time when the state-of-the-art computer was a collection of tubes the size of a locomotive with less memory than the chip in your microwave oven. But Turing had no interest in intellectual lint-picking. He proposed a simple practical test which has come to bear his name. You put a machine in one room and a person in another, and you let a human judge talk to both of them over a teletype. If the judge can't tell which is which, then we have to say that for all purposes, the machine is thinking. The Turing test has fascinated philosophers and computer scientists ever since. Turing himself thought that a computer would be able to pass it before the end of the century. A while ago, an industrialist offered a $100,000 prize for the first program that could pass a full Turing test, and recently the first official test was held in Boston. It pitted 6 computer programs and 2 human confederates against 10 human judges, none of them programmers. It wasn't actually a full test, since each of the programs was limited to talking about a specific subject like Burgundy wines or Shakespeare. Still, a number of the programs fooled some of the judges, and one of them fooled 5 of the 10 and took home a $1,500 prize for its limited success. I didn't find this particularly astonishing because I'd recalled a story that I'd heard from the computer scientist Danny Bobrow. Back in 1967, Bobrow was playing around with a program called ELIZA. ELIZA was designed by the artificial intelligence pioneer Joseph Weizenbaum to stimulate psychotherapeutic discourse. You typed a sentence on the teletype, and ELIZA picked up certain keywords and asked you a question back. One night, somebody had been working late with the program and accidentally left it running on the teletype. Early the next morning, a vice president of the company came into the office with a customer who wanted to look at the computer. The vice president saw the teletype plugged in and thought Bobrow was connected to the other end. He typed in, "Do you think I can use the computer this morning?" The program answered, "Why do you ask?" The vice president said, "I might be able to make some additional telecom sales." The program picked up that "might" and said, "Why aren't you sure?" The vice president said, "My customers haven't seen a demonstration of the system." The program asked, "Does this mean very much to you?" The vice president answered, "Of course it does." The program said, "You sound very positive." The vice president said, "This is ridiculous." The program asked, "What do you mean this is ridiculous?" This went on for a couple more exchanges until the vice president picked up a phone and called Bobrow at his office. "Why are you being so snotty to me?" To which Bobrow answered, "What do you mean, why am I being so snotty to you?" It took a while to sort things out. So what does this all prove about computers? Not much. Clearly they can talk, and they can reason in a feral sort of way, and if you want to say they're thinking, there's nobody who can prove you wrong. But that isn't what leads people to mistake them for humans. What fooled the vice president wasn't Eliza's intelligence, but its irrationality. Who but a human could be so uncooperative and ornery? Of course, in this case, the program's personality was mostly in the mind of the person who was reading human motives into its responses. Still, it's fair to ask whether a machine could achieve this perverseness entirely on its own. Maybe the deep philosophical question is not, can machines think, but can machines bust our chops? It suggests a strategy for anybody who wants to design a program to win the Turing test and take home the $100,000. Think of it. You sit down at the terminal and type in a question, and the program says, "Look, I'm not really interested in playing games right now."
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin, who also directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Two men were released from prison this week after serving 17 years for a murder they didn't commit. On the next Fresh Air, we meet the man responsible for reopening their case and the cases of several others who were unjustly convicted. Also, the author of a new book about the FBI surveillance of American writers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.